stop this fantasy and grow up and let's make 10,000 new nuclear reactors and we can live for 10,000 years in peace and prosperity. That's that.
Today we are welcoming the one and only John Kutch onto the show. I'm Sean Kenny, and this is Rock Logic. Hi, John. Welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
No problems. Our pleasure. Just kind of getting into it. So you founded and you're currently the head of the Thorium Energy Alliance. For those who are not familiar with your organization, do you want to just kind of touch base on what the organization, what the organization does, how you got started, that whole thing?
So the short version of the story is I run an engineering consultancy, and years ago, back around 2005, 2007, I had a client that was asking about some materials for his process, and one of the material, he didn't know what he was talking about, so he was just saying everything in the periodic table, and he just said, "Can thorium work?" And I'm like, "I never even heard of this stuff." So I went and looked up thorium, and I came back to him, and I said, "No, thorium won't work. You know, it's garbage." And he said, "It's garbage." I said, "Yeah, but it could save the world." And he's like, "Wait, if it's garbage, how can it save the world?" And I basically explained to him, it's, you know, now today it's considered just a nuisance and a mining waste. But there was a time when, you know, it was thought of as the next nuclear fuel and had fabulous properties for metals and catalysts and all sorts of stuff. And we used to do a lot of stuff with thorium. And that so enthralled me that me and a few folks started Thorium Energy Alliance back in 2009 officially, and that's when we had our first conference. And it was originally, Thorium Energy Alliance was much more focused on the energy aspect of thorium, and specifically we really had a thing for molten salt reactors and the molten salt reactor experiment and Alvin Weinberg's work at Oak Ridge National Lab and the unbelievably fantastic crew that got the original molten salt reactor running, you know, 55 years ago. But lately I've been trying to get Thorium Energy Alliance to think more about the material uses of thorium again, and support some of the uses, things like alloys, medicines, isotopes, catalysts, things like that. So that's where Thorium Energy Alliance came from and what we're doing in a hopefully tiny nutshell for you.
Interesting. You kind of touched on, obviously we've talked about all the power app, or most of the power applications. We like to talk about process applications. I do want to ask you about that later, but you mentioned non-power applications like alloys and such. Do you want to touch on that a little bit? Because that's something about thorium that I'm a little unfamiliar with.
Sure. So there was a great deal of metallurgy done on thorium from the you could go back to lighting. So even today, you know, thorium, if it was easier to use, would make for a fantastic basis of lighting elements, LED lamps, super high intensity discharge lamps. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's always anything that's an actinide, anything that's, you know, radioactive is going to cause people to have unreasonable concerns. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you go back to gas lantern mantles in the 1890s. So we had a pretty good understanding of thorium and a lot of its properties and its fluorescent properties and availability in the Earth's mantle and where you get it from. But after World War II, there was just a huge, you know, in all sorts of technological areas, but one area was metallurgy. And so when they started developing uses for thorium, they found out that they could make a thing called MagThor, which was magnesium thorium. And that was your Gemini spacecraft were, you know, and almost all manned spacecraft had large amounts of MagThor in them.
Really?
And yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
I did not know that.
I got to spend more time on my website there.
So, I do. Apparently, this is like
Magthor was the real famous one, and it was used in fighter jets, Phantom jets, and
wow.
Then you had Thorchrome, and there was just a bunch of different alloys that were developed that could do really amazing things: high temperature, lightweight. And they sort of fell out of favor. But I was surprised in our research to find out that there was still a refinery in Illinois making thorium alloys up until the mid to late 90s. So there was a big demand for this stuff. And it sort of became just, you know, too cumbersome to work with through regulations.
Sure.
But today we're trying to bring it back, because we know now we could do a highly automated refinery. Any of the problems with handling this material before it was melted into an alloy could be, you know, taken over by automation and robotic handling. So you wouldn't have any humans getting a snoot full of dust or anything like that. Mm. And once it's bound up in an alloy, it's not going to go anywhere. Hmm. So there's all sorts of, you know, I don't know if that's enough about alloys. I mean, you can imagine if you had super tough, super high temperature alloys.
Well,
the whole world needs these.
I'm actually kind of curious about that, because you said we kind of had an entire industry about making thorium, you know, alloy materials up until the 1990s, and then we just stopped making it because of the regulations. You want to bring it back. Are there any specific advantages on thorium? Sorry, I got kind of tangled up here. Are there any specific advantages on using thorized or thorium-based materials for certain alloys than using, you know, I mean, we talked about airplanes and spacecraft. Like, is there any benefit for, like, Elon Musk to put it on a spaceship or you know, Lockheed? Oh, okay.
Yeah, because it's, you know, it's you know, a combination of super high temperature resistant, creep resistant material that's very, very lightweight. And, you know, there's no reason it should be expensive. And and what I always tell people is this was developed very quickly. And, you know, we've only just scratched the surface of what the metallurgical possibilities are. We have, you know, we have computational ways of doing metallurgy now where we can actually tell the computer, hey, we've got this thorium, you know, what kind of crystal structures do you get when you take, you know, I don't know, like thorium, boron, and, you know, aluminum, what would you get then? You know, you'd get Alumithor, you know, and, you know, so there was Magthor, Alumithor, Thorchrome, and there was a handful of others, but they were sort of hit or miss. People had an idea, and they were just sort of like, you know, dumping in, you know, Eye of Newt, you know, Lip of Toad, and they were just experimenting. But now we have such excellent understanding that if somebody were to want to utilize thorium, there's so many opportunities for developing catalysts. You know what, you know, the magnetron in your microwave, you know, somewhere within feet of you is a thorium magnetron, right? So we still use thorium products. And so your microwave has thorium in it. You know, the welding, you can still get thoriated welding rods, which is the best type of welding rod you can use for sort of TIG welding and very advanced metal joining materials. So, I mean, there's still product out there being made with thorium, but it's, you know, it's vanishingly small compared to what it used to be. But I have a feeling some of our economic adversaries and competitors are going to, you know, they're not idiots. They know they have this stockpile of thorium sitting around, and the advantages to using it are too great to just let it sit there. They're not going to throw it away like we do. They're going to utilize that resource. I mean, so not to bounce around too much, but you got a digital editor there. You can make sense.
That's perfect. And by the way, in terms of our adversary, you can say China. I have no problem saying China. We've certainly talked about them you know, quite a bit on this show. I mean, and you're absolutely right. I mean, look, they're basically digging up, you know, rare earth materials. They're dumping acid in the ground. They're separating the thorium and they're leaving it in bags, just baking in the desert sun in the Gobi Desert. Yeah. I mean, they know, look, this stuff's valuable. We don't need it right now, but we know it's not going to kill anybody. We're just going to leave it here. And when we're ready to go, we're going to
steal it.
Yeah, I mean, why would they?
Yeah, it weighs too much. You know, it's not going to blow away. You know, so
that's true. But no, I mean, that actually kind of touches into my next question, and we'll get back into power applications later. But before we do, obviously, one of the biggest, one of my biggest draws to thorium specifically is the fact that it's attached to the rare earth mining industry. You know, when you go and dig heavy monazite sands, there's a lot of thorium in it. You have to separate it, and then that thorium has to go somewhere. And obviously, the reason we don't do it here, it's not because we don't have it. We have we have tons. We just have a lot of regulations related to thorium and, you know, various other forms of, forgive me for saying waste. I know it's not waste,
go ahead. If, you know, I have spoken about this before, so there's some record of it, but it bears repeating that, you know, I'm not a religious guy, but, you know, if I were, I would find it very tempting to say, you know, there is some intelligent effort going on that somehow gave us these rare earth minerals, right? They're called phosphate minerals. And it seems funny to me that we have this fairly untapped resource of phosphate materials like monazite, where you've got all the phosphor you need for fertilizer, which we need for a population that's going to explode to 10 billion people. We've got all the exotic materials in there, like rare earths and other metals that we need for advanced living and computers and cars. And we've got the energy to run it. The uranium and the thorium, and somebody put that all in one rock, you know? And so it's like, it does make you wonder. It's like, oh, maybe I'm wrong about this. maybe there is somebody planning this stuff for us. But so xenotime, bastnasite, apatite, monazite, all these phosphate minerals are such an unbelievable opportunity to, you know, to create all, if we could restart this industry in the United States. We used to be the biggest producer of rare earths, and then France was second, and then China in the mid 80s, you know, got into it out of nowhere because they realized they had a lot of these things called ionic clays. I won't, you know, get too deep in the weeds there, but China used to have a lot of rare earths, and they're kind of running out now, so that's why they're, you know, stomping around the world looking for all sorts of minerals, including rare earths. You know, they're looking for cobalt and tantalum. Well, they're looking for rare earths too, right? And so, but it's such an unbelievably fabulous, dense material. Now, it's difficult to work with. It's radioactive. You know, it's got actinides in it, which some people get upset about, you know, but the fact is, you know, a little bit of rare earth has fabulous energy content, huge amounts of fertilizer, a large array of exotic materials like rare earths that we need. We need these things. And, you know, so it's one of my huge efforts through the Thorium Energy Alliance and my partners in the rare earth industry to restart a rare earth refinery in the United States. If you are at all interested in legislation, the sad thing is all the legislation that keeps being put out there is about relaxing mining standards and getting rid of environmental standards. Like, you don't need to do that. We're already digging up all the rare earths we need. Every iron mine, every titanium mine, every phosphate mine in Florida that's being mined for fertilizer is creating giant amounts of rare earth concentrates, essentially. So why aren't we utilizing this? Well, we don't utilize it because we've got a crazy aversion to just pulling on our big boy panties and dealing with the thorium. And because we actually don't have to deal with the uranium, there's a market for uranium, right? Sure. So there's an easy way to sell the uranium off. But the thorium becomes an issue. And none of the legislation out there, except for our cooperative rare earth thorium bank legislation, ever dealt with the thorium issue and the refining issue. So we've recently reintroduced a piece of legislation. It doesn't have a cute little name yet, but the legislation is basically takes a slightly different approach to encouraging production. And so it's a production incentive legislation. And by doing that, it basically says, hey, it sort of comes at it from the direction of it's like, well, we need a refinery and we need a way to store and utilize thorium. So instead we come at it from the other way. It says, hey, if you're willing to build a refinery and store and utilize thorium, then, you know, and you start creating things like magnets and alloys and things like that, we will, you know, you'll have certain incentives to do that. So it's just a, you know, it's comes at the problem from a direction where nobody can complain about it, because as you were talking about, the Voldemort of nations, you know, always, you know, uses their interlocutors to raise objections to our legislation, because what would our legislation do? It would break their monopoly, right? And so they have a 99% monopoly or 100% monopoly on some of the most exotic rare earths.
I will ask this, and this is really interesting. So there's new legislation. Actually, that doesn't surprise me, because I know in 2019, I know that Marco Rubio had a bill that he was introducing in the Senate that was a rare earth cooperative. So you had some hand in that. Oh, yeah. We did some coverage on that a while back, and then we. And obviously there's been some other like executive orders under the previous administration. There's been a lot of people concerned about the supply shortages. So there's obviously people who are like now taking notice and saying, okay, well, we can't have 100% of our manufacturing in China. You know, they're talking about opening up semiconductor plants and stuff. Have you noticed any shift, any paradigm shift in Congress in terms of them looking at rare earths in this way? Have you received any like positive feedback from any of our legislative officials? I was just saying fantastic.
I thought you were like, we lost the signal.
I'm relieved that somebody is finally doing, or at least listening to you guys. But no, I'm sorry, please.
Know, we had, as you pointed out, we did have Marco Rubio, and before that, we had others introduce the bill, and you know, Joe Manchin and Cory Booker had signed on to it, and so it was a bipartisan. It's always been bipartisan legislation, and. Mm. It's always like everybody is like, man, we love the domestic rare earth part of it. Could you just get rid of that thorium stuff? Because, you know, nobody. And we're like, you can't. That's the whole point. You know, you can't. Mm-hmm. Nobody is going to touch this stuff. I mean, the reason an iron mine throws away $1 billion of rare earths is because there's a more than $1 billion liability of dealing with actinides, right? And so why would a titanium mine throw away, you know, $20 billion worth of monazite? Well, because they just don't want to deal with the things that come with it. So if we could just grow up and have a response, believe me, we work with stuff that is vastly more dangerous than thorium, right? Anhydrous ammonia is given to farmers, you know, who pull up on their pickup truck and can pull away with a 1,000-liter tank of anhydrous ammonia that would kill a city of 50,000 people, right? Mm-hmm. And so we don't seem to worry about that, but, you know, a couple kilograms of thorium nitrate or thorium oxide and people lose their minds, you know? So it's just an irrational fear based out of ignorance, which I guess, you know, is the basis of irrationality. And, you know, but the point is the legislation we have, I think, finally gets to the point where it just says, look, we will allow you to work with these materials. And as long as you work with them, and we're not even asking for the regulations to be changed. Like I said earlier, we don't need relaxed mining. We don't need relaxed EPA or anything, you know, or NRC. We don't need it. We essentially just need to be allowed to do it. And if that happens, you know, we will once again have a domestic metals, alloys, magnets, all the other stuff, garnets, phosphors, all the stuff we could make out of rare earths. And, you know, right now you got companies, you know, that are basically owned and financed by Shanghai Resources that are saying, oh, we're going to make magnets domestically. It's like, well, no, what you're going to do is you're going to get a billet of magnet material. Mm. You're going to get a little grinder out and grind it into a shape that one of your clients wants. You're going to pay Jed to take a stamp and stamp made in USA. And you're going to say, hey, that magnet's made in USA. I have some foreign components, right? Because they're not going to make the powder, the magnetized material, the neodymium, iron, boron. They're not going to make it in the USA unless we have this legislation. What they will do is get billets and ingots, and they'll mill them to the right shape, and they'll call that making magnets and making other components. And they'll apply for an exception from the Department of Energy, or they'll apply for an exception from the Department of Defense, and they'll get it, because otherwise the F-30 flies canopy is going to fly off, or, you know, Elon Musk's space capsule is going to crash into the sea. So we need this stuff. And we've basically, you know, there's a large contingent of industry that is willing to roll on its back and just, you know, let one more industrial sector fall to external controls.
Yeah. I'm actually glad you mentioned the F-35. We definitely don't want the canopy to fall out, because I'm actually based here in Fort Worth, and the factory where they make the F-35 is literally down the street. So I wouldn't want that to fall on my house.
Well, there's a Reuters article from a few years back, and I'll send it to you, and you can post it, or, you know, put it, pop it up into the corner or something. But, you know, it talks about the insane amount of manufacturing exceptions. Basically, you're not supposed to have any foreign content, but the F-35 is just riddled with foreign content. So there's hundreds and hundreds of exceptions and permissions granted for foreign content of the F-35 and the Raptor and all this other stuff. So it's just, it's maddening when you see all the work. You know, people go to all this trouble to get rules put into place, and then they're almost instantaneously circumvented, you know.
Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons, and the audience doesn't know this, but one of the reasons I actually started this podcast, not the main reason, but one of the reasons why I started the show, was I was listening to a Spotify podcast. I forget what the name of the show was. And there are these two people that were talking, and this guy who, let's just say that I think he's a smart person and I would never call him an idiot. He made a statement that I thought was, incredibly ignorant. He said, well, China makes all of our, you know, pharmaceuticals. Thank God they don't make our Patriot missile systems. And I'm like, well, no, they do. There's a subcontractor that makes all the components that make the Patriot missile batteries work. Why? Yeah. And then it made me realize that there's literally an entire, I won't say an entire segment of people, but there's a bunch of people out there who are really smart. They know their stuff. They're shaping political discourse, and they have literally no idea that the key components that are necessary for the defense of this country are made in China, or at least the parts that make the system actually work. And that's,
well, and it's an exceedingly Pollyannish view that, until 2011, they said, oh, China will never utilize rare earths as an economic weapon, until they did just that against Japan. And and suddenly we realized, oh, they would hurt their own economy in order to really hurt somebody else's economy. Yeah. You know, so this idea that, oh, China has more to lose, they don't care. You know, they know that they'll lose it and then they'll recover it faster than we ever will. And so it's very interesting. And so I think that your audience, one thing that we might reveal to them today is that, you know, that there is this, everything is interconnected, right? We can't have rare earths. We can't have phosphorus fertilizers unless we deal with actinides. And we can't pretend that, you know, the boogeyman's going to go away and we're going to be ostriches with our head in our sand. Everything that we're about here at Thorium Energy Alliance is trying to get us to grow up and, you know, and stop being, we need to realize if we want to live this high on the pyramid and have, you know, supercomputers in our pocket and, you know, little laptops with phosphorus screens and all the other things, starter motors in your car and everything else that, that is affected, fantastic CAT scans, holmium lasers, over the horizon radar, you know, just everything. We cannot have the things of the future that we want. Oh, I don't know, like windmills and solar cells and electric cars, if that's your thing, you know, you're not going to have them. You better find a way to deal with the actinide issue, all right? Mm. And it's not that big of an issue. Stop making it. This is my endless argument that I've been beating my brain against rocks on for 15 years. It's like, grow up, let's deal with it. Oh, we don't know how to deal with it. It's like, we've known how to deal with it for 75 years, right? And, you know, it goes back to that whole, this culture of excessive safety is gets so out of hand that you actually become less, you get to a point, it seems counterintuitive that you get to a point of such excessive safety that you've actually made things more dangerous from, so it's nuts. And it belies this whole idea that there's is there an existential crisis or isn't there, right? You know, when there's a burning building, do you not send somebody into the burning building to rescue the baby? Oh, but there's a life at stake. Yeah, all of our lives are at stake. And our home is on fire and somebody needs to run into it. Now, we don't want them to die and we're going to give them gas masks and protective clothing, you know, but we want them to go in and rescue the 50 people in the burning building, right? Somebody's got to try the vaccine. Somebody's got to fly the airplane for the first time and it might crash. Somebody's got to go in the spaceship and it might burn up, you know, or we can go backwards, which is exactly what the deindustrializers want. I mean, that is exactly, there's a lot of people out there who are like, we should go backwards. We should live in mud huts, sod huts, and, you know, we should live by candles. And then you have to explain to them, you know, fuckface, The candles release carbon dioxide, assholes. And what are they made from? They're made from petrochemicals or, you know, wax out of a bee's ass. And so it's like you're going to have to burn stuff. If you want to go back to the way we were living, let me tell you what that was like. We were burning coal. You know, we were burning whales. We were capturing whales and setting them on fire. So that, if you glorify and venerate a deindustrialized age, that's the insane age. And so that's going to be the death of 4 or 5 billion people, which, you know, I don't know, maybe that'll heal the earth, you know, but if you want that on your hands, you know, we can have a life of prosperity and abundance, you know, and you know, I would rather have a moderated amount of people on this earth than 10 billion, believe me. But if we're going to have 8 billion people on the earth in the next 10 years, well, we better figure out how to give them their level of lifestyle that we enjoy, or else they're going to burn rocks to do it, and they're going to burn oil to do it, and they're going to burn, you know, earth farts made out of methane to do it, and they're going to murder the earth to have what we have. So we better give the world nuclear power. It, you know, it's the only thing that's six million times more energy dense than what we're doing now. You're never going to do it with solar. You're never going to do it with wind. Batteries are bullshit. They're wasteful. They're toxic. They don't add capacity. I mean, it's stop this fantasy and grow up and let's make 10,000 new nuclear reactors and we can live for 10,000 years in peace and prosperity. That's that. That's all there is to it. Simple. I just solved it for you. Problem solved. See you later. This was an enjoyable podcast.
Okay. So could not agree with you more. And that is literally the basis of this entire channel. So thank you for saying that. Primarily when it comes to rare earths, and we're going to get to the other stuff later, but yeah. I feel like it'd be doing a disservice to my audience if I didn't go into specifics about what this, I'm familiar with how your thorium co-op legislation works, but just in layman's terms, for someone who doesn't understand the importance of this, let's say I'm somebody who just found out about thorium. I want to see how thorium can get into the market, how it can benefit, you know, but I know that there's all these regulations. How would, you know, let's just say in a fantasy scenario where Congress gets together and we say, you know what, we're going to pass this bill, it passes through the Senate, passes through the House, Biden signs it, it goes into law, and we have this thorium co-op legislation. What happens next? What exactly does this legislation do that allows the United States going from an economy that doesn't get involved in rare earths and make its own materials and all this other stuff to one that does? And how does thorium, or I should say, how does the co-op help us get to the point where we're starting to produce our own molten salt reactors and stuff like that? If you want to touch on that.
So the cooperative approach that we would still, I would say we would still try and pursue,
yeah,
comes down to you have a monopolistic adversarial power that is willing to use that monopoly power to distort and destroy markets, right? And so, and it's diabolical. They'll let the price of, let's say, neodymium, you know, or praseodymium rise up to, like, let's say, you know, like $1,000 a kilogram or something, oh, right? Jesus. And then people will be like, oh shit, I'm going to get into there. And then they sort of start to get in there, and then just as they're about to introduce a praseodymium product, right then China's like, oh, did we say 1,000? Well, we're a monopoly, so we're going to lower it to $10. And they're like, oh my God, 99% of the value just went away. It's like, oh, it's actually 99.9% of the value, but, you know, who's counting, you know? And so so then they go bankrupt. So that's what happened to MP Materials, right? MP Materials goes bankrupt. They destroy $4 billion worth of investor money. They get sold in bankruptcy. Now a new company buys them, you know, and they get financed. Shockingly, they get financed by Shengi Resources, and now the treadmill starts again. Hey, we're going to introduce domestically produced batteries. La 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 la. Boom, the rug gets pulled out from under them. And what China is doing by that is they're saying, don't get into this, because if you get into this, we'll pull the rug out every time. We will pull the rug out every time. And if we don't pull out the rug that way, we'll cut you off here, or even an ancillary product, we'll cut you off there. So how the question of the cooperative is, how do you short circuit that? Well, you short circuit it by getting the producers and the off takers to finally work together, right? So you get anybody who's making rare earths, you know, minerals, concentrates, just byproducts, just it's coming out of your phosphate stream, it's coming out of your titanium stream, it's coming out of your iron stream. You're throwing it away anyways. So you put it into the supply chain. The cooperative is a refinery. It takes it, you know, grinds it up, does things to it, you know, digests it, separates it, electrolyzes it into metals, blah, 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 all that stuff, makes products out of it. And the other half of the cooperative is the off-takers. So the off-takers would be companies making magnets or electronics or, you know, lenses or phosphates or whatever. And they would say, we will buy this at whatever it costs a cooperative to make the materials at, even if China screws with the price, even if we can get it cheaper from China, we will still buy our set amount. And this is nothing new. This is how every corn elevator works. This is how a lot of insurance programs work. It's probably how your electric company works. A huge amount of electric companies around the country work this way. They're cooperatives. Tropicana orange juice is a cooperative, right? You know, Land O'Lakes butter, cooperative. You know, so we're not like, what we get a lot of times is when we push this, you know, we get conservative people saying, you're doing some sort of like hippie commune thing. And we get liberals saying, this is some sort of monopoly thing. So it's so funny how your worldview can like take something as simple as a cooperative and distort it into what you don't like. But the fact is, a cooperative is a form of insurance. Okay, so if you're making this stuff and you're taking this stuff and you work together, you know, just like a grain elevator, mom and apple pie and Chevrolets and, you know, America, cooperatives are part of the greatest things that America invented. We invented that, right? I mean, so we use this cooperative nature to make it so that our adversaries can't distort the market, because there is no market left. We're saying, hey, you give us this material, we'll process it, and you also pay some sort of membership, you know, and maybe you get that back in some sort of profit some years you don't. But we take this liability, right? Because what's the liability? The liability is otherwise you have hundreds and thousands of kilograms of actinide sitting on your property, right? And so we'll take that because we find it valuable. And we'll take that thorium, we'll take that uranium, we'll sell the uranium into existing uranium markets for you. We'll take the thorium, and if nothing else, we'll store it. We'll safely store it, and we'll guard it, and we'll measure it, and we'll report on it, and we'll make sure that we know where every femto, every little microgram of thorium is kept, and we'll keep it in a double vaulted building right on site forever until we find uses for it, which we obviously, and so in the end, one of the possible funding mechanisms among many, I mean, we have discussions about how this would work, but one of the nice things is you could take the excess capital, sometimes called profits, but you could take the excess capital that the cooperative might make, maybe in a good year, the off-takers and the inputters and the facility itself run especially well. Now we have some excess capital, and we can use that to fund things like the rollout of molten salt reactor technology, MOX fuel technology that uses thorium. And so it's nice. It serves mining and off and, you know, people who would generate the minerals. It serves the people who desperately, desperately need them. And we find a use for this intense 6 million times denser than coal fuel. And as we've spoke about earlier, there's a lot of things you can do with thorium. You know, you can make coatings with them, nuclear medicine with them, and you can make alloys with them, and of course you can make really great fuel with it. So that's the cooperative model. The new legislation that we introduced basically comes at it a little bit differently. The most simple way to think about it is sort of, if you set this up without our assistance, we'll, you know, basically reward you for doing that. And so it's just a little bit different take, but it's still a model that needs, you know, participation from the supply chain and the off-taking chain. And so it's a little bit of a horse of a different color. But basically what it comes down to is it solves the fact that we have no way to get to metals. And if anybody talks to you about rare earths, and right before your eyes roll up in the back of your head out of boredom, you know, but right before you pass out, just say, what about metals? Metals, metals. And they'll all have to say currently, oh, well, we're going to have to rely on China to make our metals for us and our, you know, magnet material. We're the only solution that I've ever heard of where we can make metals in America or the Western world for that matter. I mean, I want to do it in America. I'm American. I'm kind of a patriot, but you know, I want the Western world to have access to these materials. So maybe we use some vendors in Germany. Maybe there's some vendors in France. Maybe there's some vendors in England, you know, Brazil, you know, Australia. I mean, this is a worldwide effort, you know? So I hope that didn't go too far afield.
No, I when it comes to this stuff, I'm the last person on earth who will ever think that. No, that was perfect, and I'm in a complete agreement with you. I want to see this obviously come to fruition.
We can also, you can scrub our website, or if you want more, if you're like, I don't want to look at John's weirdly pasty face talking about this stuff for so long, we can supply you lots of graphics and animations and things like that that'll help. Allay the boredom of looking at the.
So I will say this will make the cut. My producer just made a little dance over here. So she's very. So yes, we will definitely integrate that into the.
Normally making it myself.
we have like no budget here. It's basically just whenever we do make some money, we kind of reinvest it in here, and we'll put it into like a teleprompter or like t-shirts or whatever. We just started getting into selling t-shirts, so hopefully we get some revenue from that.
We're not rolling around in money, but we're always happy to like contribute and help support work like that. And we do the conference, right? So
sure.
So the Thorium Energy Alliance conference we're going to have at the National Nuclear Energy Museum in Albuquerque. They filmed a part of Breaking Bad there, in case you're wondering. So it's the first conference we're going to have in 3 years because of the whole COVID thing and such. But it's October 14th. And on the 13th, we want to have it hasn't gelled completely, but we want to have sort of like a training day, media day, podcast day, where hopefully folks like yourself and the Decouple guys and Generation Atomic and get a bunch of folks that, Isabel from Iso Bamecki's TikTok videos. And I wanted to get a lot of the new media, especially younger folks like yourself there to go and talk about this. Cause this is your guys' future. I'm like an exhausted cicada. I've been chirping about this for quite a while. I'm about to get eaten by a crow. And you guys have to like pick up the mantle and hopefully have more success, because I feel like I've beaten this into some people's consciousness and gotten this topic. We spend all of our time trying to get decision makers to understand this, right? We sort of made a strategic, and I think that was the right thing to do, but I also regret not doing more general availability to the public. I mean, we've done a lot of YouTube videos obviously, but we want the general public, we want an interested 18-year-old thinking about what degree to get to learn about this and become excited about it, and make it happen. So that's our goal right now. That's why we're introducing this new museum exhibit. The reason we're having it at the Nuclear Museum is we had an exceedingly generous funder help pay for this new exhibit that talks about Alvin Weinberg's work helping start up Oak Ridge National Lab. And, his Mount Everest was him and 30 guys building the molten salt reactor experiment and getting that reactor built in just 5 years and running it and beating it up and never having a problem, of any significance, and just a phenomenal, achievement, only to be, just left on the cutting room floor for like the last 55 years. So it's as if we landed on the moon and never went back. Imagine if that had happened. Yeah. so it's that same sort of thing that we want to just like we're supposedly going to go back to the moon and go to Mars, we need to go back to nuclear and remember the unbelievable promise that it offers.
Yeah, completely agree. Well, okay, so we passed this bill. We're building thorium molten salt reactors. We're moving ahead. Let's talk about my favorite thing. Let's talk about process applications, because I'm all about that. So, you know, you talked about making great fuels. One of the things that we've actually discussed on this show was making coal to liquid fuels using the process heat from thorium molten salt reactors. Is that something that you obviously advocate for,
we don't have any problem with that at all. You know, we actually, there's a couple talks that I give where I talk about taking coal and taking it from the blackest and dirtiest of fuels to maybe not clean, but, you know, light gray.
Yeah.
Because you can do a Fischer-Tropsch process to coal, make syngas out of coal, and then make diesel fuel or jet fuel out of it. And that's been done. This is not, you know, science fiction. It's done today in South Africa. It's been done for well over 100 years. We've known about the FT process. But the trouble is, until nuclear, it was, you know, you'd have to burn 4 tons of coal to get 1 ton of diesel, right? So that's not that great. If you could take all the coal you would burn and replace it with thermal energy and electric energy from a molten salt reactor, now you're taking 1 ton of coal and turning it into 1.3 tons of diesel fuel. You can extract the uranium from the coal and power your own fuel with it. There's more, by the way, there's more energy in the uranium in coal than there is in the coal itself. You know, isn't that wild?
I've known that for a while, and it still blows my mind that we're literally throwing away the most valuable portion of that.
Yeah, and it would be worth it to mine coal to get the uranium out of it and just throw the coal back. But the ash, a lot of the things that we find as wasteful that we send up the flue and that we inhale, particulate matter, when you can capture the lampblack, the sulfur, the uranium, some of the other elements, if you can capture it through a pyrolytic process where you're not letting it go out of a smokestack at all that stuff that's a poison becomes really valuable. You know, sulfur for rubber, lampblack for rubber, there's 1,000 things you could do with it. The ash can be used to make the world's strongest concrete. You know, the uranium can be used for fuel and medicine and all that stuff. So it's like, so that's what I mean by taking coal and turning it into something. Plus, you'd need far fewer people to be put in danger to mine it, because you wouldn't need as much. You'd be vastly improving the utilization of the coal. So you wouldn't need as much coal, but yet you'd be making, like right now, a ton of coal goes for about $55 somewhere, give or take, around there.
Sure.
A ton of diesel fuel goes for $1,800. So what would you rather make, $55 or $1,800 plus all the byproduct stuff you can sell? You know, but I was told by the one of the heads of Peabody Coal, we'd rather just sell the coal. So
really?
it's weird. You know, who knows? They get paid for how much coal they sell, right? They don't get paid for making diesel. I mean, that was what the guy said. So
that seems really short-sighted, though, because
it does seem short-sighted, seeing as the guy was supposed to be in charge of innovation.
Wow. Okay. So,
you can also take that same idea. A lot of people don't know where anything comes from, right? They don't know where the burrito in their hands comes from. You know, they don't know where the cheese in their burrito comes from. You know, they're like, I don't know, some sort of extrusion machine. You know, it's like, you know, so part of that is they don't know where their freaking gasoline comes from, right? So we burn, like, for every barrel of oil, we burn somewhere in the neighborhood of 40% of that barrel of oil making products, right? So you get about, you know, half gasoline, a third diesel, and a third other stuff like kerosene and distiller gases and, you know, a whole panoply of weird waxes and stuff like that. What if instead of burning the oil to make oil products, we had a super high temperature reactor there that could take the place of that burning? And now you get 40% more use out of your barrel of oil. So magically, boom, overnight. You're not burning the oil to make oil. You're burning, you know, thorium to make the oil products. So it's 40% cleaner right out of the gate. Is that good enough for you, environmentalists? 40% cleaner oil products. Then you need to uprate the oil, right? So you need to add a lot of hydrogen to hydrolyze it. You know, so you can make that hydrogen. Right now, you're getting hydrogen from steam methane reformation. You're ripping H's off of steam and releasing huge amounts of carbon dioxide. You know, just an insane amount. But what if we could take water, desalinate the water, deionize the water, create vast amounts of hydrogen, and we could use it to uprate fuel? Now it's even cleaner. So it's not pure as the driven snow, but it's 50, 80, 100% better. You know, you could even, at some point, depending on how long your tape lasts, you know, we could talk about carbon negative fuels. But if you're making a lot of hydrogen, now you can send that hydrogen to go make ammonia, right? So you could use ammonia to store the hydrogen, NH3, you know, there's three H's there. You could use it to burn, you know, you could actually use ammonia as a fuel. Me personally, I could think of better things to do with the ammonia. You could use it as a fertilizer. The aforementioned 8 to 10 billion people on Earth are going to want some fertilizers along with phosphate fertilizers. You need a lot of ammonia fertilizers, right? That was the Green Revolution. But right now, where do we get ammonia? We get ammonia from burning natural gas, essentially, or decomposing natural gas, I should say, in steam methane reformation. You know, and we put it through the Haber-Bosch process, which is also well over 100 years old. So I'm not talking about like something that's in a lab, like one day we could take nitrogen from the very air we breathe and convert it into a fertilizer. It's like, no, we've done this for, you know, since 1914, I believe. And so we know how to do this. We just need to change the inputs. And the inputs need to be nuclear heat, nuclear electricity, and then water from, you know, renewables, and that sense of renewable. It's like we need to find ways of using water well, right? You know, because desalinating water makes brine. Brine's bad news. So why don't we start, you know, getting MIT to look at what to use brine for? Well, MIT's come out with some good reports on what to use brine for. We can get a lot of metals out of the brine, salts out of the brine, things. Right. So, you know, the thing is, this becomes eye rolling and people's eyes glaze over because it's like, oh, you mean we have to change everything? It's like, you have to change everything, baby. So how do we make it as painless as possible? Why don't we make petroleum production as clean as humanly possible so that, you know what, the electric car and the electric airplane and the electric boat are not really going to have huge market penetration for things like, I don't know, farmers. I mean, if you live in the city, where are you going to charge your electric car? You're going to come out and see, you know, a cut off electric cord laying in the mud and no car, right? I mean, you're not going to charge electric cars on the street in the city, okay? Just let's get that out of our head, you know? And what are you going to charge your ambulances and your fire trucks, you know, your fighter air jets, you know, your transport jets? It's, you know, your over-the-road trucks might have some electrification to it. But the fact is, are you really going to ask Bob, the truck driver, to throw away his $1 million truck just so he can be a little bit greener? No, you know, like there's going to be legacy combustion engines out there. So why don't we run them on synthetic fuels and super, super cleanly refined petroleum fuels? You know, we need a transition, and the transition could take generations, because in the next 10 years, we're still going to make 3 billion new reciprocating gasoline 4-stroke engines. You know, no matter how many electric cars you make, there's going to be 3 billion new engines in the world. We might as well feed them with, you know, the most beautiful fuel we can, because we're not going to. It's just like the guy in India deserves electricity, and he knows he deserves electricity. Yeah. How's he going to get it? Well, if he has to burn those black rocks, he's going to do it. And if we can give him a way to not burn those black rocks, that's even better. Even better than that would be to say, hey, I know your job is to dig those black rocks out of the ground. we're going to help you transition from that. We're going to give you a way to use some of those black rocks, and you're going to transition from burning those black rocks in a big oven to decomposing them into lots of valuable products. And eventually you'll transition because you'll realize it's even more cost effective to just take brackish, unusable water and clean it up, take it, make hydrogen, and then make hydrocarbons from that hydrogen and do something with the oxygen. By the way, if you've got an idea of what to do with a couple billion kilograms of of oxygen, let me know. I'm thinking there should be some sort of tax credit, because if you put all the oxygen from electrolysis in the air, it's sort of like diluting the air, you know? The solution to pollution is dilution. So maybe you get instead of a tax, a penalty for making, you know, a ton of carbon dioxide, you also get paid to make a ton of oxygen, you know? So you thin out the atmosphere a little bit.
I have no problem with advocating for that. I think there's some long-term benefits.
Well,
I
mean, you know, it sounds funny, but until you think about it, you know, we burn 18 million barrels of oil just in the United States a day, yeah. Right? That's just the United States. Worldwide, I think it's something like 38 million barrels of oil a day.
It's definitely higher than that.
The point is try and replace that with hydrogen economy, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, the takeaway from that is whatever it is, you know, it's X million billion, you know, gallons of fuel that, unless you want to go back to a horse and carriage, you know, which is not actually environmentally responsible, but unless you want to go way back in your standard of living and get rid of plastics and get rid of medicines and get rid of all the things that make our life livable, then you better come up with a way to make millions of tons of hydrogen and then millions of tons of petrochemicals and millions of tons of plastic every year, you know, and figure out how to recycle them, figure out how to, you know, suck carbon from the atmosphere if you think that's a solution. But you better start thinking at that scale, because some guy who puts two solar cells on his camper and is like, I'm roughing it in the outback and I have solar cells on my roof. It's like, yeah, what does that do? Does that charge your cell phone after about a week of sitting in the sun? Great. Mm-hmm. You know, now try and drive your four-wheel drive truck that you dragged your camper out with, you know, try and drive that home on your solar power, you know, or your Tesla, or your, you know, your 1,000 horsepower Tesla Plaid, or your Rivian. I mean, it's like, you know, it's insane, you know, that people are getting into this idea that we're going to rebuild an entire infrastructure based on solar and wind. And it just shows you that our ability to do math really sucks.
Yeah. So fun fact, before she bought the house that we're currently filming this episode in, you actually did that. She actually tried to rough it in the wild. She was basically living out of
I did live in a trailer in the woods in the middle of nowhere for 6 months.
She did do that while she was saving up money to buy a house. And then we had the deep freeze here and she's like, nah, I'm buying a house. I'm kidding. So if we want to talk about somebody with real experience on trying to make that work and not Jessica, like she was like, no, yeah, that's.
I've got a farm in Iowa and there's some small little bit of video out there in the world where I talk about it, but we don't have power. You know, land power, and I don't have, you know, city water or nothing. So I've got to bring my water out there and I got to bring all my waste out. And I have solar cells and I had plans to put a windmill in because we used to do a lot of work with the National Renewable Energy Lab. And I have my battery banks, but I also have two generators out there because even though we don't have air conditioning, and we have like some fans and we have like a little, you know, we have the most minimal amount of electricity you can imagine. Our radios are crank radios with little solar cells on them, you know, so we don't even play. The point is, like, even with that level of roughing it, chemical toilets, you know, all that stuff, we still would run out of electricity.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that was sort of my awakening back in 2005, 2004. Yeah. I'm like, there's something really wrong here. You know, we're not going to be able to live, you know, and I think it's actually great for everybody to realize how much crap they use, how much energy they use, how much they rely on flipping a switch and getting something to go on without having to go outside and start up a generator or put some alligator clips on a marine battery, you know, you know, and running to the store to get another bottle of propane that, you know, it's like, that would be hugely beneficial for people to understand how much energy and resources they use. And then to have to take their garbage home with them, then they'd realize, shit, man, I make a lot of garbage, you know? And so, I don't know. That's be neither here nor there, but
we did a whole episode last year on electric cars, and you know, we have an engineer that we correspond with up in Saskatchewan who I said, look, we want to do an episode about Tesla, we want to do an episode about electric cars, and he basically told us, you know, I got to tell you, the real problem that I have with people who talk about energy issues with renewables and all this stuff, they don't address the major issue related to electric cars. I'm like, what is it? Is it rare earths? Is it, you know, materials? Like, no, it's electricity. You need to produce more. If you get rid of X amount of gasoline powered cars, you have to replace it with, and you replace it with, you know, a similar amount of electric cars. Okay, well, you got to do some simple arithmetic, find out how much energy do I need to produce relative to what these cars need to do. And we did the numbers. It was something like we need to produce like 40% more energy that we do now over the next 10 years if we're going to do Elon Musk's dream, make everything electric. Can we do it? Yes, but we got to get, as you say,
by deindustrializing the American economy and European economy, we found that we didn't have to upgrade. You know, we thought we were going to need twice as much electricity as we do now back in the 70s. Well, between efficiency and deindustrialization, it turns out we use just about as much electricity today as we did back 40 years ago. So we haven't put in long-haul transmission lines. We haven't put, but now, you know, all these people want to put 1,000 windmills in some place in the middle of Iowa where the wind always blows. That's curtailed and thrown away energy because they can't get it where it's needed. Chicago needs it. Denver needs it. Minneapolis needs it. But God forbid you try and put a high power, you know, 437 kV line going through, you know, even rural America where you'd pay them a lot of money. They're like, no. So the NIMBYism and the hypocrisy and the cynical hypocrisy of this idea that you're going to, you know, cover the desert in solar cells, you know, and in the meantime, you're going to murder all the tortoises and wildlife out there, but that's okay. No one lives out there. Who's going to know? You know, but, you know, windmills and bird strikes and murdering bats and bugs 24 hours a day in Iowa where my farm is, you know, that's fine. Who cares? All the raptor bird carcasses will be picked up, you know, but you're going to do all that, and then you're going to do the most despicable thing of all. What little shitty intermittent power you do generate, you know, windmills only make power about 15 to 20% of the time, right? 80% of that 15% gets thrown away. You know, they, because it's the inrush of electricity into the grid can't be handled, so they have to throw it away then. The sudden departure of the electricity off of the grid can't be handled, so they have to preempt it and throw it away. And then when it does come on at, I don't know, 3 a.m. when you don't need it, they have to throw it away. So even though it makes shitty electricity, the shitty icing on that shitty cake is that they're throwing away, you know, 60, 70, 80% of what little they do make. So then what do you, so if you're making a megawatt for 1 hour a day, then you need 24 windmills to charge up 23 batteries so that for that other 23 hours a day, you have power. And those windmills last what, 10, 15 years? Oh no, they last 30 years. Yeah, with an insane amount of maintenance, maybe you could get them to last 20 or 30 years. And the batteries have to be replaced every 5 or 10 years. And now you're talking about, I could have that horrible use of resources, or I could have a nuclear reactor, which essentially has infinite life, right? Mm. You know, I mean, a nuclear reactor can last 60, 80, 100 years easily because they're so insanely well-maintained, mm. you know? So I don't know. This is the frustration between they've won. I mean, I hate to admit that, but the renewable green bastards with natural gas money, you know, have won, because how do you back up a windmill that doesn't spin? How do you back up a solar cell at night? How do you back up a flow battery that it exploded? Oops, shit. You know, how do you keep the patient on the operating table from dying with natural gas gen sets? Right. Mm. So who pays for, who loves to shut down nuclear reactors? Natural gas. Who loves to promote the green robe over their naked body? You know, the emperor has no clothes. Well, the green renewable clothes that they wrap themselves in are as thin as fabric. As soon as you peel them away, you see the ugly, disgusting junk that's underneath. You know, the wart covered junk of natural gas is sitting there blowing nitrous oxide and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And they are in no way cleaner than coal, right? They might have a little bit less particulate matter, but all the methane leakage around natural gas, all the NOx, you know, natural gas burns so hot, you get a horrible NOx problem. No one talks about that, you know? And so that's, you know, that's the, you know, that's the in my view, the opponent of nuclear is natural gas. Wind and solar are going to fall apart, but natural gas, just, it's a waiting game. And so this whole fracking fiasco, you know, eventually the chickens are going to come home to roost, because the reason, I mean, they already are. What's your natural gas costs down there? Are you in Texas?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, what's your natural gas cost? Find out what your natural gas cost, you know, during the bomb cyclone was, you know, $1,000 a million BTU, you know, but natural gas wants to be $8, $9 a million BTU. And they've held it down at that $3, $4 range for 10 years now. And they haven't held it down. The myth is that they got so good at fracking. That's bullshit. There's a great book by Bethany Frankel, I think her name is. She's the one who busted Enron. She wrote a book called Saudi America. And she shows how the entirety of natural gas cost staying around $3 and $4 a million BTU has entirely been based on financing. It's all been financing magic tricks and a Ponzi scheme. Again, essentially, as fracking wells go out of business, they just get bought by another company and they run them until they're out of business. And then so it's just layer upon layer, you know, and now we're seeing the chickens come home to roost. You know, my gas bill's going up by 3X, 4X this year. Yours is, I couldn't even imagine what your guys is going to do. So it's, so they held the price down pretty long and they got about 15 nuclear reactors murdered because of it. So Kewaunee up in Wisconsin got shut down because of natural gas. Turkey, Pilgrim got shut down because of natural gas. You know, we almost lost Clinton and Byron here in Illinois because of that. You know, so it's,
well,
sorry to go.
No,
I'm relying on your editing skills to.
No. I mean, Jessica, you got your work cut out for you. I don't know if we're going to split this up into three parts or what. Yeah. I mean, we're just getting some we're getting great stuff out of John here. I'm I don't know about you. I'm loving it.
Oh no, I'm really happy. Yeah.
I could tell because you were totally laughing your ass off towards the end there. But no. It's a great insight, and shit, we might actually end up doing an episode on natural gas, but I kind of want to bring it back here a little bit because we've talked about some great stuff. I still have some other questions about some other applications that we can get into, but I also want to try and add a little bit of a dose of reality here, not so much from the regulatory side because you've covered it, but more from the supply chain side. So one thing that we've addressed in other episodes is and if anyone asks, well, what's your favorite type of, you know, reactor, I'd have to say the lifter. And there's a lot of reasons why I would say that. But I also recognize that you know, lifters, liquid fluoride, thorium reactors, they rely on a supply chain that doesn't exist, right? We're not making a lot of like highly enriched lithium seven. You know, we don't have a market for the beryllium. We're not making graphite moderated cores. And the biggest issue that, and we did a whole episode on this a few months ago, is while we do have the largest supply of uranium-233 on this planet, the geniuses at the Department of Energy are trying to dispose of it. They're trying to denature it and get rid of it.
And they're giving whatever they don't dispose of to Bill Gates to use. We'll see what he uses it for. Theoretically, it's going to be for nuclear medicine, but I have a feeling he's going to use some of it in a molten salt reactor. I don't know. We'll see.
Wouldn't have any objection to that. I mean, you know, but I mean, that's interesting. I didn't actually know that TerraPower had some of that U-233.
To get it, but.
Here's a question. How much of this, like, I don't know what the exact number is, and I've looked at certain sources, but it always changes, and I don't know who to trust. How much uranium-233 do we have, and how much of that, like, how many reactors could we start from that U-233? I have another follow-up question to that, but I guess, I mean, how much has been...
I'll start by saying, like, the inventory I've heard of, I can just say generally there's basically were two major sources of it. You know, roughly there was some from the molten salt reactor experiment program that was at Oak Ridge National Lab, and they're in the process of doing disposition of it, and I believe they're sending some of it over to Y-12. And then there's some other U-233 that was made into a MOX fuel with thorium and used as an experiment in some of the solid fuel reactors, water-cooled light water reactors.
Like shipping port?
Yeah. So there's some of that, and that's stored at some of our national labs. But it's vanishingly small, you know. It's like maybe 3 tons at Oak Ridge and 5 tons at one of the storage reservations, and some of it does need to be gotten rid of. You know, some of the salt was highly it had a lot of stuff in it that today with our stupid monkey brains we don't know what to do with, but you know, we have some highly energetic stuff in there that some people would call waste. That's just too problematic to deal with. So we just need to cask it up and, put it somewhere and giant hole in the ground or a salt cavern or something. Sure. But there is some good stuff left, which is what I am sure some of the folks want to get their hands on, because, you know, they still at Oak Ridge, they've been promoting this milking process. But the fact is, you only need, a couple kilograms would last years and years, right? Because you only need, small amounts of these medical isotopes to actually have hugely gigantic benefits in the medical isotope community. The sea change and the success and the efficacy of medical isotopes, if we could start including bismuth 213 and actinium into the isotope mix, would be hugely beneficial. But you're really not going to use a lot of U-233 for that, right?
No.
So where would you use the U-233? Well, it would be logical to say, hey, we should try and start up some pure cycle reactor with that. Mm-hmm. Now, as you pointed out, the pure cycle is, it's really cool on paper, but it's hugely problematic to actually execute it.
Yeah.
But U-233 plus thorium, even in a solid fuel reactor, could be a very good thing, could make for a very good fuel. But it's not, we venerate it quite a bit, but it is not the be all and end all of nuclear fuels. No. The pure cycle would be great, But so would breeder and light water reactors feeding off of each other, right? So I mean, there's other ways we could skin this cat. You know, we could make a, you know, the holy grail is to make a closed cycle, right? To close the loop. You know, that's the holy grail. So you got the Russians with their BN-800. Beautiful video out there that they just released about the BN-800. And, you know, that is a huge leap forward to closing the loop. You know, they should be congratulated for that. But, you know, that's a sodium reactor. Some people freak out about that. They think the sodium is going to explode in the air. But, you know, EBR-2 ran for, what, 36 years. You know, it was built when we knew nothing about reactors, and it managed to run for 36 years. So, I mean, those old guys must have been pretty good craftsmen. But so that might be a little bit of a wandering answer to you. Like, there's somewhere around, let's say, 8 tons of U-233. A lot of it probably isn't super usable. The stuff that is usable is very valuable, potentially as a fuel, you know, certainly as a nuclear medicine basis. But, you know, in the end, as great as it is, we don't need it. I mean, we can do this with other things. We could do it with plutonium, right? We could make thorium-plutonium MOX. And it's like, how many reactors could you start it up? I mean, that gets deep in the weeds. It's like, well, do you need that reactor to kick on right away? Or are you willing to let it do a slow start, right? So you could, if you're willing to wait a pretty long time, you know, you could start with a very little fizzle load, and it could start to self-breed its own fuel and get going, right? But it's a difference between, you know, I don't know what a good analogy would be. You know, it'd be a difference between, you know, starting a gas stove where it just poofs comes on, and, you know, having to start a fire in your fireplace. And so you got to start with a match and then some kindling and then some twigs and then a log, you know, and you sort of build up, you know. So you eventually get to the same place where you can make your eggs and coffee in the morning.
Sure.
But one just takes a little more work.
So it's nice to have, but we have other materials. We have SNF, we have plutonium that we need to get rid of, and we could. I mean, look, we had Ed File on the show, you know, at Elysium Industries. We did a whole episode talking about, you know, burning 239 plutonium 239 and SNF in a chloride salt reactor. And what's great about you know,
so a chloride reactor would exactly do that. I mean, the chloride reactor would be an analogous to the sodium fast reactor. Breeder reactor. And so you know, Ed's probably going to be about the best guy in the world to talk about, you know, his ideas about closing the loop on that. And so, I mean, that's the takeaway phrase, though, and all that is like the holy grail that we should all be working towards in nuclear is closing the loop, because that would take our enemy's main bitch away of saying, oh, but you've got waste. And it's like, no, we don't have waste. We have the most exotic materials in the universe ever created. And, you know, we're about as smart as medieval blacksmiths. You know, we just don't know. We don't have any idea of what we have, right? We barely understand the metallurgy of thorium. We have, you know, vanishingly small understanding of the metallurgy of uranium. You know, we just came out with the third plutonium handbook, you know, after, you know, 80 years, you know. And so it's like, you know, we are just little tiny babies, you know, when it comes to our understanding. That doesn't mean we're not safe. We're all so safe, you know. But the point is, like, you know, the stuff that these ignorant people call, you know, waste, and it's going to be radioactive for 10,000 years. It's like, yeah, you want it to be radioactive for 10,000 years, you idiot. That means it's not very radioactive. You know, stuff that's radioactive for 10 minutes, keep that shit away from me, because that means it's giving up all its energy right now. You know, that's what nuclear medicine is. That's why you got to get the Moly 99 in you within a few hours, because after, you know, a day, it's done its thing. It's destroyed your tumor and it's gone away, you know. But, you know, if you've got something, you know, thorium is radioactive. Get this. Don't be frightened. 14.5 billion year half-life. Does that freak you out, man? You know, no, of course it doesn't, because you know that that means it's nearly inert, right?
Yeah, I mean, you could probably eat this stuff, and
yeah, well, you could, in big enough chunks, you could eat it. It might do some weird things to your biome in there, but you'd pass it through because your body doesn't know what to do with it. You know, you don't want to inhale it. You know, inhale small particulate matters of anything. Don't inhale small particulate matters of baking powder. Don't inhale coal dust, and don't inhale uranium dust or plutonium dust. You know, like, no shit. Like, idea. thanks, geniuses. That can cause a.
Damn, I'm gonna do that later.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, dust is bad. You know.
Yeah.
Alpha emitting radioactive dust is a little bit worse. You know. Mm. So don't go and do it. And that that circles back to what we were talking about. One of the things Thorium Energy Alliance is trying to do is modernize all these interesting ways that people had of making lenses and alloys and catalysts. You know, before they literally made them by hand, but we think we can use modern material handling automation. And so that's what, you know, in case you're interested, that's one of the things we're going to talk about at the, we're going to have the 11th Thorium Energy Alliance Conference. TAC 11 is going to be in Albuquerque, New Mexico at the Nuclear Energy Museum on October 4th, 2022. Got to get that little plug in there. But, you know, if you and every nerd you know want to nerd out for, you know, 48 to 72 hours, we're going to try and we're not going to try. We already paid our money. So if I'm just sitting in the parking lot drinking beer one way or another, I'm showing up to Albuquerque on October 14th.
We'll be there. That's a short drive for us. So we're going to be there with a camera. Right. Well, probably more than one camera. Just, you know,
yeah. And you'd have a ton of people you could interview. You know, you'd have some really knowledgeable people who could talk about everything from just general nuclear. And sadly, you know, we lost Dick Engel several years ago, about 4 years ago, who was the man, who was the chief engineer for the mole. And so these guys, this is one of my greatest fears, is we're losing this knowledge base, you know, and we're not rebuilding it fast enough. Mm. So hopefully anytime I can catch an old timer on video or on the record, it's, you know, you're doing God's work, because, you know, someday, you know, the slightest bit of insight is going to become hugely valuable. Mm. Now, these guys ran a molten salt reactor. Even the Chinese haven't done it yet. You know, no one's done it again in the last, you know, like I said, imagine if we'd landed on the moon in the 60s and just never went back again. It'd be insane. People would think, what'd you do that for? Mm. You know, the molten salt reactor experiment was the landing on the moon of nuclear. Mm. You know, we didn't deserve these men and women who made such a unbelievable, I mean, they may as well made a time machine. They may as well have made, you know, it's like, The technological achievement with the tools they had is so moving to me that I get like choked up to think that the phenomenal talent these guys had and the industrial might of America back then was so phenomenal that they could do this. Mm. You know, it was shocking to think of the utter beauty of what they did, just the beautiful engineering. And the reports they did were written like novels. They're the most beautifully written, easy to read reports. I'd recommend the few that are available out there publicly, you know, will inspire anybody who wants to be an engineer. Mm. Sorry, I digress.
Please. No, this is why we had you on the show. I'm enjoying every second of this. So, I know at some point we do need to wrap up, and I probably. We have 15
minutes left on the roll.
15 minutes. Okay, great. Well, John, if you've got 15 minutes, I still have questions, and we're probably going to go back and forth here. So obviously, God, where do I go from here? That was just, well, first off, we're definitely coming to Albuquerque. There's just no question. We're going to drive up there, and we're going to probably talk to you. And, I don't know who else is coming. I'm assuming all the big. I'm sure all the big startups are going to be there. ThorCon, Elysium, probably.
Yeah, we hope so. You know, we hope to get TerraPower to send one of their guys again. I mean, I think they're doing great work. I wish they'd be a little more open about what they're doing, but I don't blame them for keeping their cards close to their vest. Mm. I'd love it if Toshiba and GE sent somebody, Hitachi. I would kill to have Ross Adam, send somebody to the conference. Mm. But, we do have a lot of researchers do a lot of excellent work and even independent work. We've gotten lots of support in the past from national labs and Nuclear Infrastructure Council and the Electric Power Research Institute have all come to the conference before and talked about their work and their hopes and their dreams. So, but we've got some speakers, but it's the mystery box right now. We'll see who we'll see who shows up, because like the whole COVID thing and stuff adds a little layer of uncertainty to it. But like I said, if one way or another, me and Vince Lukowski will be sitting in the parking lot of the nuclear museum with a 12 pack and sitting on the tailgate and talking in the parking lot.
We'll join you. We'll probably just do an entire episode just doing that. It's like Jessica and I drove cross country to Albuquerque, like in the hopes of filming a conference, but they closed it because of COVID. But that's okay, because John was there. Early, at least talk about some stuff. No, we definitely are probably going to have you come back on the show, as many times as you want, because this has probably been the best episode. I can say without a doubt, this is like the best episode we've ever recorded. So thank you.
Oh, that's nice. Well, yeah. And if anything, I'm kind of have a few notes of my own on my upper monitor, and we've spoken a lot about a lot of stuff. One thing, if you want to, chop this out and stick it back where we're things in terms of fuels, we didn't really, we spoke a little bit about U-233, but we should speak about thorium's, fuel aspect. We spoke quite a bit about the rare earths, and we've touched upon the things you can do with thorium, which is really nice. That there was so much technology developed for thorium, since the 1800s. Mm. But as a fuel, one of the companies that I'm proud of and I want to become more involved with is Clean Core Thorium Energy, CCTE. Mm. And they have a fuel, a thorium oxide uranium HALEU fuel, right? Mm. So it's designed especially to work in CANDU reactors. And one reason I really like it is the organization behind it is pretty small and nimble, and yet they've gotten their fuel bundles built. They are doing irradiation testing right now. They're well down the path of getting it to be a licensed fuel. They don't have to do anything about the form factor. It's a direct replacement for the CANDU fuel bundles. It's just the secret candy center is a little bit different. Just putting the supply chain together could be hugely beneficial for America's nuclear interests between supplying HALEU and supplying thorium oxide. We could initiate and fulfill some 1-2-3 agreements that are left hanging out there that would, that would be part of our nuclear diplomacy. So, you hit upon things like this where we can have a better relationship with some of our allies and we can provide better energy. And, you also get a better, so that's a very political thing that could happen because of this, but it'd be creating jobs. It'd be creating opportunity. And the one beautiful benefit is you get, the guys at CCTE will kill me, but for not having the exact specs, but you'll get a much, much better burn up rate improved burn-up efficiency of this fuel. So the bundles will last about twice as long as they do now. So you'll make a lot less waste. You'll make a lot less spent nuclear fuel, and you'll make a lot less plutonium, which is a little bit of an issue up there in Canada and Argentina.
Sure.
And so there's 35 working CANDU reactors in the world. You know, maybe we could get back to building some new CANDU reactors, build bigger CANDU reactors, simplified CANDU reactors, because it's the CANDU's a technological marvel. Canada should be proud of it. It's served exceedingly well all these years. You know, and if you could take all that learning and simplify it a little bit, it is kind of an oddly complex system, but they've run it safely for all these years. And it has, it's a hugely beneficial fuel and design because it's an online refueler. So now we could do things like put samples in there and irradiate them and get new materials, new medicines, new isotopes. So I'm pretty excited about the Anil fuel making it through the fuel qualification and getting licensed. And that just shows you that a small dedicated team could make a huge difference. You know, somebody listening to this might get a bug in their ass and say, you know, why can't I get Lightbridge to bring their cruciform thorium fuel to market? Maybe I'll go to work with Lightbridge and get their revolutionary fuel introduced. And that too, a lot like Anil, would vastly improve the burn-up efficiency of fuel. And it would be an inherently safe solid fuel form factor. You know, so, I mean, it gets, I hope it's not too boring to talk about stuff like this, but it's like, some kid's not going to find it boring. You know, some girl out there is going to say, hey, I can take the greatest, most energy dense fuel and more fully utilize it and take these. You know, you were asking earlier, or you mentioned, like, what's your favorite reactor? My favorite reactor is the one that's running right now. You know, like we have, you know, we have a fleet of these light water and boiling water reactors, and we have to keep them running. You know, we have to keep Diablo Canyon open. You know, my second favorite reactor would be a molten salt reactor of any flavor. You know, if we could get molten salt cooled pebble bed reactors like Kairos, you know, if they can get it across the finish line, then that's my favorite. You know, it's like, just, we got to get back in this game. You know, the Chinese have the LF1 and good for them. You know, I want, you know, one, they've got a billion people they got to pull out of poverty. They've already pulled 500 million people. If they do billion people on the back of coal, they're going to murder the earth, right? Same thing with India. You know, if India tries to pull a billion people out of poverty on the back of coal, they're going to murder. So we better pray to God they adopt nuclear big and bad, you know. But, you know, and we hope Russia, you know, sells 5,000 floating reactors to every poor country in the world. And we hope Thorcon sells, you know, 5,000 more reactors to India and Malaysia and, you know, wherever they can, you know. But until then, we better keep that fleet running. So my favorite reactor is any reactor that's running.
I'm literally about like 35, like 40 miles away from Comanche Peak, which is one of two nuclear power plants here in Texas. And I'm just thankful that I live near one. I was living in Southern California for 5 years. So
that's why you won't have energy blackouts, because the nuclear reactor runs every, you know, like we just had 17 below zero the other day. And we were joking. It's like Byron running at 130% efficiency for 10 hours, you know, because, you know, the colder it is, the better they run.
One of the smartest decisions I made was moving out here to Texas. So, you know, not the primary reason why I came out here, but thank you, Jessica, for making the sale.
Where'd you move from?
Well, I was living in California, in Glendale, which is in Southern California, Los Angeles area. Before that, I was in Virginia. I'm from Fairfax County originally.
Okay, great.
And I actually wasn't too far away from D.C. Actually, before I came out to California, I've had a lot of different jobs, but I worked with the And this is kind of where my love affair with thorium came into play, is I worked at the American Roke and Ray Society, which is a medical trade association that deals with radiological science, and we publish I was doing graphic design work for them. I was doing some editing work for them. And, you know, and one of these articles I was looking at, we talk a lot about moly 99, technetium 99. We were talking about bismuth 213, and they were talking about, you know, these studies that they were doing where they were treating brain cancer with this, like, you know, highly, you know, and I'm looking, and, you know, they're like, out of the 47, like 46 of them were cured. Like, is this a typo, or is this like, no, this is like, this is legit happens. Like, okay. I'm a bit shocked by that, because if what I'm reading here is right, it's the cure for cancer. So why am I not hearing this on mainstream media? Why isn't there like this massive popular, you know, science uproar on that? I got 5 minutes.
Have you ever read that report? The one and only report that was simultaneously co-authored by both the Department of Energy and the Department of Health. And in the NIH, it's basically just a pants wetting scream and cry to please make more bismuth 213 and more actinium.
I know,
because they had like 1 gram of it, and or like a half a gram, but with like a half a gram, they treated 20 people and they cured 18 out of 20. They had a response rate that was so phenomenal, and they basically said, We must get more of this, and yet we're just barely starting to make more of it now. And you know, it's a hugely, so it's definitely a lost opportunity. But medical isotopes is a whole kettle of fish. You know, the trouble is you need so little of them to make such a huge effect that all these companies want to get into medical isotopes. But you know, if you make 5 grams, you might flood the market. And then you get this whipsawing where it's like companies come in, they go bankrupt, then they come in, then they go bankrupt. And it's like feast or famine. And so we need to figure out ways to level out and sort of have a sane market for medical isotopes. And then we can have nice things again.
For sure. Well, on that note, John, it's been great having you here. Any final thoughts or anything you want to convey before we end the?
Thorium will save the world. Just ask me how. And make sure you check out the Thorium Energy Alliance website. We will have the conference there and how to register and all sorts of ways to support the work we do. Like you said, t-shirts, DVDs, you know, thorium coins, stickers, swag. And of course you could just have a membership, and out of the goodness of your heart, you could just keep our efforts going along. And I really am very grateful that you allowed me to speak to your audience. Thank you very much.
I'm grateful that you came on here. This has been the most fun I've had all week. So thank you for coming on the show.
All right, it's Taco Tuesday, man. I'm going to get out there.
All right, sounds good.